I'm Maria McKenzie, and welcome to Untamed Pen, where words and inspiration meet. Today, we're going to look at some interracial political scandals that have inspired some intriguing novels. Political scandals are a dime a dozen, and lots of movies, TV shows, and novels feature that juicy topic that keeps eyes glued to the screen or fingers turning pages. The titillating television series Scandal ran for 6 years on ABC, and if you're not familiar with that show, it's centered around Olivia Pope. While working on a gubernatorial campaign as a media relations consultant, Olivia had an affair with then-candidate Fitzgerald Thomas Grant III. Now working as a crisis manager or a political fixer, she's called upon to fix a scandal in the president's office. However, the president now residing in office just happens to be Fitzgerald Thomas Grant III, and his affair with Olivia begins all over again. And by the way, Olivia's black and Grant is white. Now, forbidden love is nothing new in politics, but throw race into the mix and becomes explosive. So let's take a look at some of these interracial love scandals from the past. According to the Monticello website, the claim that Thomas Jefferson fathered children with Sally Hemings, a slave at Monticello, entered the public arena during Jefferson's first term as president, and it's remained a subject of discussion and disagreement for two centuries. In September 1802, political journalist James T. Collender, a disaffected former ally of Jefferson, wrote in a Richmond newspaper that Jefferson had for many years kept as his concubine one of his own slaves. "Her name is Sally," Callender continued, adding that Jefferson had several children by her. Now, you can visit the Monticello website for further factual information. And the novel Sally Hemings by Barbara Chase Ribaud provides a fascinating fictional account. I read that novel one summer when I was in high school, and it was very absorbing, and I really enjoyed it. It was the winner of the Kafka Prize for Best Novel by an American Woman in 1979. And the New York Times said, "One of the great American stories gives new luster to the words historical novel, vastly enjoyable." Now, here's a description from its Amazon page. "One of the greatest love stories in American history is also one of the least known and most controversial. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States and author of the Declaration of Independence, had a mistress for 38 years whom he loved and lived with until he died, the beautiful and elusive quadroon Sally Hemings. In this brilliant novel spanning two continents, 60 years, and seven presidencies, Barbara Chase Ribaud recreates a love story based on the documents and the evidence of the day, but gives free rein to the novelist's imagination. Incredibly written and beautifully evoked, Barbara Chase Ribaud explores the complex blend of love and hate, tenderness and cruelty, freedom and bondage that made the lifelong liaison between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson one of the most poignant, tragic, and unforgettable chapters in the history of the races and of the sexes in America." And I will just add, if you enjoy historical fiction, you will definitely enjoy Sally Hemings. Now, another novel based on the Sally Hemings-Thomas Jefferson relationship is One Drop of Me by Harry Krause. Now, the website Fantastic Fiction provides a great synopsis. "The accidental drowning of her young son shattered Lisa Griffin's perfect life. She finds her own breath again as she writes the gripping narrative of slave Sally Hemings' relationship with her white master and eventual president Thomas Jefferson. As she gives Sally the voice she never had, Lisa finds her own way to freedom from an oppressive marriage. A contemporary rich white doctor's wife, a black colonial slave, separated by time, race, and money, united by betrayal, bonded by tragedy, one in their search for freedom." I read One Drop of Me a few years ago, and I absolutely loved it. This novel opens in the present while the main character Lisa recovers from the trauma of losing her son. To help herself cope, Lisa starts writing a play about Sally Hemings, and as the story progresses, the reader sees parallels between Lisa's life and the life of Sally Hemings. Sally Hemings. The narrative moves back and forth from the present to the past, so we get a clear picture of Lisa's day-to-day existence as well as that of Sally's. This novel was really hard to put down, so if you love history as well as some great storytelling, be sure to check out One Drop of Me. Now, another interesting scandal revolves around Vice President Richard Mentor Johnson and his mixed race, or as they said back in the day, mulatto, Julia Chen. Johnson served as vice president under Martin Van Buren. Now, there has not been a novel inspired by their relationship, but they are referred to briefly in distinguished historian Thomas Fleming's novel, The Wages of Fame, a pre-Civil War family saga. Now, I did read that novel several years ago, and I found it enjoyable, although some might find there's more history than storytelling, but I still recommend it. Now, Undercover Black Man says, how much of a Negro was Julia Chen? Well, she was a slave Johnson inherited from his father. She was Negro enough that Richard Johnson couldn't have married her legally, yet she was his mate, his common law wife in effect. She was the hostess at his Kentucky home when French aristocrat the Marquis de Lafayette visited. So that just gives you an idea that Richard Mentor Johnson had as his mate a mixed race woman. Now, Johnson served in Kentucky's state legislature from 1804 to 1806 and again in 1819. He was in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1807 to 1819 and again from 1829 to 1837. And he was in the U.S. Senate from 1819 to 1829 prior to his becoming vice president. Now, Abraham Lincoln exploited Johnson's relationship with Chen to score a point against Stephen Douglas during the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, and this is what he said. I have never seen, to my knowledge, a man, woman, or child who was in favor of producing a perfect equality, social and political, between Negroes and white men. I recollect of but one distinguished instance that I ever heard of so frequently as to be entirely satisfied of its correctness, and that is the case of Judge Douglas's old friend, Colonel Richard M. Johnson. Now, we're going to move forward through time to one of the most recent political indiscretions, and the indiscretion took place in the 1920s, but it was not revealed until, oh gosh, I think maybe 2009, 2010. But anyway, it was the one that involved South Carolina Senator and segregationist Strom Thurmond. When he was 23, he had a love affair with his family's African-American maid, Carrie Butler, who was 15. Now, Newsday mentioned in its obituary of Thurmond that rumors flew for years in South Carolina that Thurmond, while still a segregationist, had a relationship with a black woman that produced a daughter. Jack Bass, author of the Thurmond biography, Old Strom, says Thurmond never denied it, though he kept it under the rug for years. Thurmond's love child from his relationship, Essie Mae Washington Williams, penned her memoir, Dear Senator, in 2005. She waited until after her father's death at age 100 to reveal his secret. A Publisher's Weekly review of Dear Senator explains that Carrie Butler died at 38 in a hospital's poverty ward. Although she rarely appears in the memoir, Miss Washington Williams fashions her a kind of love story. I knew Thurmond loved my mother. I believed he loved me after his fashion. Well, the love story of Miss Washington portrayed in Dear Senator provided the inspiration for my novel, The Governor's Sons, a provocative tale that examines a politically incorrect relationship of a young law student who falls in love with his family's hired help, a college-age black girl. So now I'd like to do a reading from The Governor's Sons, and I'm going to take a few moments to set the scene. First of all, it's summertime. Ashcroft is 23. And Ash is the son of a wealthy political family. Now, he'd been a school teacher for a couple of years, but he will be attending law school in the fall. So, you know, as I said, during the summertime. He teaches some night classes and he works in his father's law school. I'm sorry, his father's law firm a few days a week. It's summertime, so he still got a little time to get in trouble. Now, his mother just hired Kitty Wilkes to work as a maid during the summer. And when Ash first sees Kitty, he's smitten and Kitty thinks he's handsome. Kitty is a flirt. Ash is he's an overconfident know-it-all. And though he knows it's wrong to pursue Kitty, he just can't help himself. So one late morning when Ash arrives home from a workout, he's just in time to see Kitty leave the house to pick peaches. She smiles, he follows. So right now I'm going to do a reading from chapter 2 of The Governor's Sons. As Ash began to climb the back porch steps, Kitty opened the back door. He stopped. Her presence never failed to send a surge of electricity through him. It was still early morning, and Ash had just driven home from swimming laps at the country club. He hadn't seen Kitty at all today. As she descended the stairs, he moved aside to let her pass. She held a basket in one hand and smiled. "Hey, Ash." Several days ago, she'd stopped calling him Mr. Ash when no one else was around. "I'm off to pick peaches for a cobbler that Aunt Isola's gonna bake later." She stopped inches from him at the bottom step. "But I think she and Betty Jean just wanted me out of the kitchen since I can't cook." Ash didn't say anything. In his mind, he was too busy peeling off her clothes. Smiling, Kitty cocked her head to the side. "Cat got your tongue?"
"No, course not. I'm never at a loss for words."
Kitty laughed. "I know." She turned on the ball of her foot and strode away. Ash watched her go. He continued watching as he backed up the steps. He dropped his gym bag on the porch, still gazing in Kitty's direction. She walked slowly as a gentle breeze blew the skirt of her dress gracefully around her legs. It would take Kitty about 5 minutes to reach the peach orchard. It was behind the mansion, hidden beyond a large cluster of oak trees. The Croths' white-clapboard house, freshly painted with shiny black shutters, sat on a low, sloping hill. The mansion was surrounded by 3 acres of land, scattered with white magnolias and pink crepe myrtle. Ash's father owned about 1,000 more acres up in the northern part of the country worked by sharecroppers. Ash could still see Kitty off in the distance. He jumped down the 6 steps by 3s and began following her. The air was fragrant with honeysuckle and magnolia, and except for a slight rustling of leaves, all was quiet. When he called to her, she appeared not to hear him, but he wondered if she really could. Kitty, Cat, both names suited her because she liked to toy with him as a cat plays with a mouse before killing it. But being near her wouldn't be dangerous, Ash reflected, if he could keep his feelings out of it. He knew the emotions that stirred inside him weren't right. A dalliance with a Negro girl should be kept at that, a dalliance, with no emotional attachment. However, it was already too late for Ash. He told himself he shouldn't be out here looking at her, following her, but he couldn't help it. "Kitty!" he called again. This time, she glanced over her shoulder and smiled, but then looked ahead and kept walking. Ash gazed at her, thinking how sensual she was. Her walk, her smile, her voice all jarred his senses to oblivion. From behind, he watched the simple blue dress sway alluringly about her hips. She strode with a straight back and head held high. Her strides were queenly yet seductive. Ash, wearing khaki pants and a mint green sports shirt, began jogging. When he finally caught up to her, Kitty said, "What are you doing all the way out here?" He smiled. "I thought you needed help."
"You certainly like helping me."
"You got a problem with that?" They held each other's gaze for a few seconds.
"I don't," Kitty said. "But what about your daddy? He doesn't mind you not working 5 days a week in his law office this summer?"
"No, 2 days is good enough." "But 2 days isn't enough to keep you out of trouble.
And I've got my teaching twice a week."
"But you're still around to cause mischief during the day since you teach at night. So just how many adults are in those reading classes?"
"About 1 dozen, but there should be more. Some folks are too ashamed to admit they can't read."
"Well,
I think what you're doing is right admirable. It's necessary, Ash said. In this day and age, there's no excuse for illiteracy. Now see, when I'm governor, I'm going to put some reading programs into place. That way, everyone will know how to read in this state. Knowledge is power. Especially what?
Nothing.
Ash knew what she was thinking, especially if you're white. But he didn't force the issue. It was true. They walked silently for a few moments. Guess you could say I'm taking it easy this summer. Once I'm in law school, then start politic, and I won't have much time to call my own, so I hope you don't mind me helping you out since I got some free time on my hands.
Oh, I appreciate your help. Seems like you know everything. From drying dishes to hanging linens on the clothesline, you're an expert. And no matter what I do, you've got a lecture on how to do it better.
Ash stopped walking, then grabbed Kitty's arm with a tug. Unable to move, she stiffened. Her eyes widened as though afraid.
What was I giving you a lecture about a few days ago? That time when you teased me, Ash asked.
Her lips parted slightly, but she didn't say anything. Ash released her arm, then shoved his hands into his pockets. Kitty's stiffness disappeared. She smiled and relaxed.
So? He returned her smile. You know what day I'm talking about, don't you? Mother offered a Tuesday bridge luncheon, Isolde and Betty Jean gone to market, and you and me alone washing dishes.
Kitty looked down for a moment, then grinned. By the look on her face, Ash assumed she was blushing, but her dark skin prevented him from knowing that for sure. When Kitty began walking again, Ash followed.
You were talking too much. I wanted you to shut up, she winked.
Yeah, and when you reached to kiss me, I lost my train of thought. One second you act like you want to kiss me, then the next you pull away. Why'd you do that?
Kitty hesitated.
Because you stopped talking, and because Aunt Isola warned me about you.
What'd she say?
That sometimes you don't act as gentlemanly as your brother does. So I was just testing you, Kitty said coyly.
You passed. She moved her basket from one hand to the other.
When I pulled away, you didn't try to make me change my mind.
Ash took a breath to speak, but before he could, Kitty changed the subject.
Well, today I'm just picking peaches. I doubt there's anything you can teach me about that.
Her tone almost seemed a challenge.
Are you kidding? Ash said as they approached the small orchard.
Peaches hung invitingly from the branches, and the smell of ripening fruit wafted through the air.
When I was growing up, we lived out in the country, and Heath and I had to do chores right along with the Negroes that worked our land. My dad made sure we showed them the same respect we would anybody else. Respecting others, no matter what. That's one of the best lessons Dad ever taught me.
So what lesson do you suppose you can teach me about picking peaches? Kitty asked.
Well, since I grew up cultivating peaches and since I have a degree in agriculture.
Oh, Ash, Kitty laughed. Stop talking. I'll just pick one, then you can give me a lecture.
Kitty gazed up into the glossy leaves. Ash watched as her slender arm rose to pluck a peach. Even this innocuous action oozed sensuality to him.
Think fast.
Kitty tossed the peach to him and laughed. He almost missed, distracted by a hint of lace peeking from the neckline of her dress.
Is that a good one? She asked.
Ash squeezed the fruit, then smelled it.
Not bad, but not perfect. When you pick peaches, they need to be firm, with a little give to them, and they should have a deep, sweet, peachy smell.
Well, I figured since that one had a rosy red skin, it'd be just right.
But rosy red skin doesn't mean it's ripe enough to pick.
Ash took the basket, placed the peach inside, then set it on the ground. What you want to look for instead is a deep yellow background color. He looked up, then pointed high above them. Like that one.
Kitty tried to reach the peach he indicated, but couldn't. It's too high.
Now it's not, Ash said, grabbing her by the waist and lifting her up. Kitty laughed as she was hoisted into the air. After she pulled on the peach, snapping it free from the branch, Ash slowly lowered her to the ground. Kitty held the peach between them, but Ash didn't remove his eyes from hers.
Now, that one looks perfect, he said, still not looking at the fruit. But the best way to test it is to taste it.
Ash took the peach from her hand, then touched it to her lips. Kitty held his gaze and took a deep, sensual bite.
Juice burst from the peach, trickling to her chin. Ash brushed it away with his thumb, then licked the juice from his finger. "Now it's my turn," he said, before she could eat any more. "You don't mind if we share, do you?" Kitty smiled, shaking her head. "I wouldn't dare deprive you of something this good. It's sweet." Before Ash bit into it, he said, "And it feels just firm enough, and I can see how juicy it is." They ate the peach together, the only sound between them soft laughter. After they finished, Ash threw the pit aside into the soil. "I reckon we can't test each one now, can we?" Kitty smiled. "I reckon not." Silently, they picked peaches until the basket was filled. When both reached down to pick it up, their heads collided. While they laughed, Ash rubbed his head and said, "I'll carry the basket." But when the laughing stopped, neither of them moved. They looked into each other's eyes. When Ash bent to kiss her this time, Kitty let him. He slipped his arms around her waist, pulling her against him in a firm embrace. When his kiss deepened, Kitty encircled her arms around his neck. But after a few seconds, she gently pushed him away. "Anna Zola is probably looking for me about right now. We need to head back." Ash hesitated. He wanted to keep kissing her. And he wanted more than that, and even more than that. Anything he'd say now wouldn't make sense. So instead, he just grabbed the basket. They walked toward the house without a word between them for several moments.
"So who's Russell?" he asked.
"Russell?" Kitty laughed. "How'd you hear about him?"
"Oh, I heard Betty Jean tell Isola how much he likes you."
"Oh," Kitty smiled.
"So?"
"So what?"
"So who is he? Are you talking to him?" Ash demanded.
"About what?" She batted her eyes.
"You know what I mean. Are you seeing him?"
"Oh," she sighed, "kind of."
"Kind of? You either are or you aren't."
"Well, Ash, that's really none of your business now, is it?"
As Kitty casually strode ahead, she left Ash behind, smoldering. And that concludes Chapter 2 of The Governor's Sons. Thank you so much for listening. Please visit me at www.mariamackenziewrites.com and visit my Facebook page for links from today's podcast. Until next time, this is Maria Mackenzie.